Bill Lynn of DRS Technologies, writing in Foreign Affairs, how the Pentagon is adapting to globalization. Bill, it's terrific to talk to you again, as always. You write about Big Dog, an acquisition by Google from Boston Dynamics. And tell me what Big Dog is and what relevance that has to the Department of Defense. Thanks for being here today.
Sure. Big Dog is a robotic technology that's had applications in the Department of Defense. Google has gone out and purchased it, but they didn't really purchase it for its defense applications. It has broader applications, but it's illustrative of a general issue with commercial companies like Google, who have important technologies for the Department of Defense, but who are not terribly interested in doing business with the Department of Defense because it's so difficult. When they look at the panoply of opportunities they have, they find that they can get better return on other markets, other potential customers, and so they tend to pull back from DOD. Not so bad for them because it's not that big a piece of their market. Pretty bad for DOD, where in cases like Big Dog, the technology has potential importance in terms of maintaining our military superiority.
You write about the numbers that are involved here. The market value of Google, more than double that of General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon put together. And you mentioned that Google has $60 billion in cash on hand. This is a relatively new development, that the scope of some of these companies, most of them technology, but not all of them, is so far out in front of what the defense industrial base looks like, isn't it? I don't recall this dynamic being in place throughout our history.
Certainly not throughout our history. I think if you look to the late 90s, probably had somewhat similar numbers during the so-called tech bubble. But you know what it shows is that those companies are their growth is going to be more dynamic. Their capacity in terms of their ability to deploy cash is going to be greater than the defense companies.
And that brings about two possibilities that I think we should consider. If their growth is more dynamic, what are they doing that companies in the defense industrial base could be doing to generate the same kind of growth? That may or may not be a valid comparison. And the other issue then is the one that you're raising in this piece, which is how does the Defense Department go about making itself more appealing as a customer to companies who are moving into these kinds of very specialized and very advanced technologies? Am I on track there?
Yeah, well, I think the second one is on track. The first, less so. Defense companies are different than technology companies. I mean, technology companies, you know, Apple, Google, they take much greater risks. They bet more of their own money, and they get higher returns. Defense companies, I mean, the model is the department largely pays the research and development costs, and the margins are lower. So you're taking somewhat less risk, and you're getting lower returns. And so it's not necessarily you shouldn't compare one to the other necessarily. It's just a different model. But the second point is right, is that as you look at the trends, it used to be that the defense establishment was really a net exporter of technology. We developed things inside the Department of Defense in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. I mean, the Boeing 707, the Dominant Airplane in the 50s and 60s came out of the development of an Air Force tanker. The global positioning system, GPS, was originally a military system. Now, of course, it's everywhere. The origins of the internet itself came out of some Defense Department research. That's no longer as dominant a model. It's really now defense has really become a net importer. As you look at the critical technologies going forward, more and more of them are outside the pure defense space, whether you look at 3D printing or nanotechnology or cyber technology more generally. The dynamic there is going to be, how do you take those technologies into the defense establishment and operationalize them for military purposes? And that is, I think, one of the keys to maintaining the technological advantages our military has enjoyed since World War II. And so how we do that, I think, is going to be a critical part of sustaining our future.
You write about how the defense industry is globalizing, and you reference the JSF, the F-35 program. 9 countries, Australia, Canada, Denmark, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Turkey, United Kingdom, and United States involved in developing and financing and testing that aircraft program. What do we learn from that about what we can expect to see, not just in major weapons systems, but all kinds of acquisitions that the Defense Department and its peers in other countries will do in the coming 5, 10, 20 years, Bill?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things you see out of the F-35 is that as these platforms have become more expensive, more capable, you need to share the burden of the development costs. And with those 9 countries, that's what we've been able to do. Second, what you get out of that is you get a common platform so that we're able to fight with our allies in a much more integrated fashion, where everybody's using not only compatible systems, but the same systems. We're able to interoperate and be much more effective as a team.
You write about the history of how the United States has supplied its arsenal, and we come to the second era, the post-World War II era, and you call that, you cite President Eisenhower calling that the military-industrial complex. And you say that ended with the Cold War, when the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union contributed to a rapid decline in military spending. What do we learn from that decline in the 90s that we can apply today as budgets contract, but the threat landscape is dramatically more complex now than it was in the 1990s?
As you indicated, I think this is, we're in a kind of a third stage. The first stage, before World War II, we had arsenals and shipyards, largely a government-controlled complex providing our weapons, supplemented during wars with some commercial activity, but that was generally demobilized, just as the Army itself was when the war ended. In World War II, we started the conglomerates' entry into the defense sphere, and what we really had was the biggest companies in American industry had defense divisions, Ford, General Motors, and so on. And we went from World War II to the end of the Cold War with that system, worked very well for us. And then, as you said, at the end of the Cold War, we had the so-called Last Supper in the Pentagon, where the Defense Department explicitly asked industry to consolidate. And what happened out of that was not only did industry consolidate, but it changed its character as well. The conglomerates largely got out. They largely sold their defense divisions. And what remained were companies that were there before, but they were smaller players. Now, the defense specialists now became the dominant tier, became the top tier of defense. So the Lockheeds, Northrop, Raytheon, where 70, 80, 90% of their revenue is coming from defense or related activities. That has continued to the present day. What I'm suggesting in the article is the general globalization of the industry and the commercialization of the technology, together with the budget cuts, is going to force another kind of change in the industry. We're going to have to adapt to those trends, and the industry structure that we've had probably can't continue unchanged.
Yeah, there certainly isn't any more room for consolidation among the biggest companies.
At the top tier, if there was consolidation, it'd be limited. I mean, there's only a half a dozen or so companies in that tier, so right. how many combinations? And the departments of defense has indicated they wouldn't look too favorably on combinations at that level because of loss of potential competition. At the second, third tier, you could see, the smaller companies, you could see more consolidation. You could also see more globalization. You could see non-U.S. companies buying, into this market. And my own company is part of Finn Mechanica, DRS Technologies, and so that trend, and Airbus is here, and BAE has a very significant presence here. So that trend is already well underway.
What's the holdup to a more of a diverse globalization of the market right now? Is it something that some policy that the Defense Department has established? Is it some legislative issue? Why is there a hesitation on to move to this globalist direction that you're talking about?
I'm not sure there's a hesitation. I just think it's a long running trend. I think you might look at the auto industry as something of an indicator. If you think back, I don't know, 30 years ago in the auto industry, it was generally thought to be almost unpatriotic to drive a European or an Asian car. But then what happened over the last 30 years is European and Asian countries have built significant plants in the U.S. U.S. legacy companies have significant sales in Asia and Europe. So you're to the point now where the largest U.S. exporter of cars right now is BMW. So it's not a European company.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the whole thing has become integrated, and so the nameplate of the company and the jobs aren't necessarily from the same. They're not the same country necessarily, and the political dynamics tend more to care about jobs than nameplate. So I think that the whole temperature on who owns or where the core ownership of the company has really lowered.
You tell an interesting story in this piece. You write, in the early years of the 21st century, the Pentagon sought to develop a new artillery system called the Crusader rather than adapt a robust German design that met most, if not all, U.S. requirements. Now, that last phrase, there were probably numerous examples we could cite about situations where there was something, whether it was developed here or in another country, that was close to what the Pentagon needed, wanted, but wasn't the 100% solution, was the 85% solution. Right. And that's another area where I sense there's still some reluctance inside the Pentagon to companies being able to, to the branches and being willing to say, you know what, this gets us close enough and it's already a mature technology. Is that a cultural issue, do you think, that has to change? Or is that, again, is that a policies and procedures issue?
It's largely, I think, a cultural issue in two ways. One is you have to be prepared to buy from overseas suppliers. They may well produce it. In fact, likely they would produce it here. As I said, the jobs are more likely to be here than there. That's tends to be the natural order of things, is that if a significant procurement pulls the production to that country. So you have to accept, though, that you're going to accept a foreign design, not necessarily foreign built. It might be U.S. built. And second, and unrelated to whether it's foreign or domestic, you have to accept that maybe there's something out there that, as you said, is an 85% solution, and that so I don't need to start a whole new development. Some of the culture of the Pentagon is to start with requirements and work their way through to a final system rather than look at what's out there and buy that off the shelf. It's not that that never happens, mm-hmm. but it happens less frequently than it probably should.
Why do you think that is?
It's a desire to have the 100%. It's a desire to have every capability that we think we might need. And it's we need to force more of the trade-offs. It's nice to have 100% of your capabilities, but it would also be nice to have it come at 50% of the cost. And as you know, Norm Augustine has written that, you know, generally the last 10% of capabilities represent 30-50% of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make those kinds of trade-offs where those high-cost items that bring only a fraction of the capability are traded off before you go into production or purchase.
But we have a track record of that now, and we've seen that happen time and time and time again, and it strikes me that we're now in sufficiently tight of a budget time where it would be reasonable for somebody to say, you know, now we just can't do this anymore. This is the time to just end this and start to be satisfied or figure out what the 85% is that we really need and live with it.
But you have to do it. I mean, the hard part is it's easy to say that in general. Uh-huh. The hard part is to apply it. But I think you have seen it. You've seen it with the airborne tanker competition. When we did that a couple of years ago when I was in the department, we limited the number of requirements and didn't buy absolutely the complete high end. We were thinking about cost. We also used, the competition was between a U.S. supplier and a European supplier. Airbus and Boeing were the only two companies in the world that could build it. And so if you didn't have a global competition, you wouldn't have any competition at all.
Mm-hmm.
Another example would be the MRAP program, where the MRAPs that protected our troops from IEDs, that was an off-the-shelf design, I believe, from South Africa, that we then put into production with a whole number of companies, and they made upgrades and so on, but we were able to get it very quickly. If that had gone through the normal process, we would have taken 5 to 8 years developing it and then another couple of years testing it, and it would be available about now, just as we're pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Instead, by the accelerated process that Secretary Gates pushed through, it was there to protect, you know, frankly, thousands of our troops from harm.
And there have been a number of folks on all sides of this argument who have said in the subsequent years that shouldn't be an alternative method of procurement. That should be the method of procurement because of the success that the program had.
Well, and that indeed is the challenge. Is, you know, in the MRAP program, the Secretary of Defense was effectively the program manager. Well, things are going to work pretty smoothly when you have that, but that's not really a process that you can apply to a lot of programs. Yeah. So the challenge is, just as you said, how do we institutionalize those kinds of processes that got us an effective system, that got us in a timely way so that we're able to deploy it when it was needed, and how do we do that kind of rapid acquisition more as a normal process rather than as an exceptional one?
You write in this piece in Foreign Affairs, if the Pentagon makes it easier for commercial and foreign companies to enter the defense industrial base, it will go a long way toward increasing competition. Now, Frank Kendall has spoken on the desire for more increased competition, for more vigorous competition on a number of occasions. I have a hard time finding anybody who agrees or would disagree with the idea that that's desirable. So what is it that you would like to see your former colleagues in the Pentagon do to make it easier for commercial and foreign companies to get in? We go back to the beginning with Google and the big dog example, where essentially the way it looks, Pentagon needs them more than they need the Pentagon, it looks like.
That was the opening point. First, Frank Kendall and others are working hard on doing exactly what you say, making it easier and less onerous for commercial firms to get in to the defense business. You're asking what specifically do you do? I think the most important focus is to lower the barriers to doing business with the department. And by that, I mean the cost accounting, the audit requirements, the rules that we have about intellectual property tend to be fairly onerous by commercial standards. I think those things, frankly, haven't really gotten worse. I'm not really saying here that the situation's gotten worse. Mm-hmm. It's more that it's gotten more important for the department to get commercial companies into the defense business. So those barriers are now more important than they may have been a decade or two ago. They haven't gotten worse, but getting over them has gotten to be more important. I think I'm somewhat encouraged by the statements you see out of Mac Thornberry and others about acquisition reform. I think he gets this point. I mean, you hear him say that his first direction is to, you know, along the lines of doctors, do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the problems with acquisition reform is you can make it worse.
Yeah.
If you add processes, add procedures, add auditors, add restrictions, which is in some ways a natural action, you will make it worse. You will make it harder for commercial companies to do business. You will actually probably increase the costs and increase the schedule for when we get systems. So I think attacking this at the root and figuring out which processes you need, which processes serve the fundamental purpose of protecting taxpayer dollars, and which are extraneous to that purposes, I think, at the core of some of our acquisition reform efforts.
And I was struck by similar comments that all the 30-some experts that submitted comments to the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations on the Senate side said. They came from all across the defense acquisition spectrum, and pretty much everybody at some point, in some way, reinforced what you just said, which is don't default to adding more words to the process. Right. That's not necessarily going to help.
Exactly. And it's an easy thing to do because it's hard to go back and pull things out and rewrite it and start from scratch. Much easier just to add to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you'll not end up with a good result.
Beyond the fact that we might see names like Google and Apple and others more integrated into the defense industrial base at some point in the future, what other markers could we look to, Bill, and say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that this effort was successful? Or is that really the big one, that some of these innovative companies that historically haven't been associated with selling into the Pentagon market are now doing so?
It's not the big companies that you probably ought to be watching, although it would be good to get them. It's the small ones. But for them, the burdens of doing business with the department are even greater. I mean, you talked about, you know, the amount of cash Google has. I mean, Google can afford to do business with the Department of Defense. They just don't find it attractive, mm-hmm. given the returns. Smaller companies can't even afford to. I mean, you know, to add a separate accounting system or a fleet of lawyers to do business in a market which may only be a fraction of your potential market is just not attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those small, innovative technology companies, those are the ones you ought to focus on.
Is this a middle ground, though, or is this a situation where it appears to you that the Pentagon should just adopt commercial practices to allow these companies to come into this market and be able to afford to play? Or is there some middle ground between the way it is now and what companies like Google have to do when they sell to their commercial customers?
It's going to have to be a middle ground. We're not going to wipe out the federal acquisition regulations for the Department of Defense. That's not desirable or realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more how do you adapt our processes to make it attractive enough to bring commercial companies in without losing the purpose of those regulations, which I say is, of course, to monitor and protect taxpayer dollars and ensure they're being spent as intended, as Congress is directed.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible to accomplish those purposes without the costs that we currently impose.
Last question. Is there one particular policy, one particular situation, anything that would be, in your view, the key to really opening the door to changing this to the benefit of the Defense Department, or is it not that simple?
It's not that simple. There's one we haven't mentioned, though. It's not quite in the same vein, but is the ITAR regulations, the export control regulations, are a significant impediment for global companies coming here. Is what you find that those restrictions at this point are so onerous that you find that international companies selling overseas, one of the first things you'll see in their pitch will be it's ITAR free. They're telling people buying it, you don't have to go through the nightmare of the U.S. export control system to buy that weapon or mm-hmm. that system. I think we need to reform our export control laws. We need to protect our critical military technologies, but the world has changed from the Cold War, where we had kind of an us and them system, and the ITAR reflected that. Now we need a system that's much more nuanced, that protects many fewer technologies, probably to a greater degree, but allows more to be out without as much regulation as we currently require.